This meeting is now being recorded.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Colin Height with the law firm of Herschler Fleischer, and on the line with me is my co-presenter, Chris Michella from Kiter.
Good afternoon, everyone.
We are ready to begin. I have muted all of the lines for all of the participants. However, we do want you to have the opportunity to ask questions, so please feel free to email us. And I'm about to give you the email address, and you can submit your questions directly to us, and we will answer them towards the end of the presentation. Please send your email to the following, cmoschella@kitercpa.com, which is kitercpa.com. I'll give you that one more time, please. cmoschella@kitercpa.com. With that, we will take those emails as they come in and then address them. As I said, we've muted the line for everybody, but however, please note that we are recording the presentation so that it will be uploaded to our websites and others can listen to it in the future. So if you continue to participate, we do ask that you agree that you are being recorded so that we can use the conference for future presentations for those that are unable to join us. With that, let's get started. We have a lot of ground to cover. My name is Colin Height. I am the practice leader at Herschler for the Cybersecurity and Data Privacy Group with the law firm, and I also lead the Insurance Recovery Group as well. Chris, go ahead.
My name is Chris Michella, and I am a manager in Kiter's Risk Advisory Services Group, and I'm also responsible for leading all the business development and service delivery in our cybersecurity niche practice.
Thank you, Chris. Go ahead, Chris, and let's start with, I think we should start for the audience at the very beginning. Can you give us an overview of what is ransomware and how did WannaCry escalate as quickly as it did?
That's a good place to start. So ransomware is a type of computer virus or a malware, and at its core, what it does is it puts a password between you and your data. So it gets on your computer, and one way or another, it prevents you from accessing your own files without the password. In order to get that password, the attackers are usually asking for a payment in the form of Bitcoin, which is a type of cryptocurrency, and it's anonymous, so they can get paid without getting caught. Ransomware typically comes in two flavors, and there's a lot of variety in between the two. One is a crypto variety, and the other is the locker variety. The crypto variety essentially encrypts all the data on your computer to prevent you from accessing it. The locker variety uses some type of application that sort of just takes over the computer and prevents you from doing anything other than paying for the ransom. And a lot of the more modern types of ransomware combine the two to make a really nasty combination. So the question is, well, what is this latest type of ransomware? How did it start? And especially, how did it stop? Well, this most recent ransomware, which has been dubbed WannaCry, started with a Windows exploit. And the exploit was actually stolen from the NSA by a group of hackers called the Shadow Brokers. And somebody has converted one of the exploits in that stolen software into this ransomware. And it basically started, how it actually started, I guess the details on that are a little bit murky. Nobody really knows whether or not it was an email or how the whole thing got going. But it leveraged a weakness in, old versions of Windows. And what made this particular type of ransomware particularly nasty is that it sort of self-propagated. So it identified a particular weakness, and with that weakness, it was able to spread through different networks. And that's what made it really, really nasty for the folks who got it, and that's one of the reasons why it spread so quickly. It was thankfully shut down quite by accident after it started by a security researcher based out of the UK. This researcher determined by reverse engineering the code that for some reason this ransomware was trying to communicate with a particular web server, but the domain name for that web server had not been registered. So this researcher said, oh, well, it hasn't been registered. I'm going to go ahead and register it. Well, as it turns out, the ransomware was relying on the fact that that domain name had not been registered to continue to function. So once this researcher spent the $12 to buy this domain name, he effectively shut down the global attack in an instant. So that's a really high level view of generally ransomware overall and how this particular attack started and how it spread and how it was shut down.
And my understanding, Chris, is, and I just read this today or this morning, that the hackers are trying to and have rewritten the code in such a way so that fix of registering the domain name has now been eliminated and it's beginning to spread again. I don't know if you've heard or seen anything on that, but I saw that this morning that it looks like it may be able to ramp back up again.
Yeah, and I expect it to come back. And now that the code, the ransomware is in the wild, not only can the original attackers fix the flaw, if you want to call it a flaw, in the original code to prevent it from being shut down so easily, but copycats can also get a hold of it, create their own varieties, and deploy that.
Could you tell us, Chris, just for everybody's edification, give us a little background on Bitcoin and how does it work and how easy is it, when you get the ransom demand, how easy is it to just up and pay in Bitcoin?
I suppose the answer to that is it depends on the level of sophistication, but these ransomware attackers, believe it or not, have some pretty good customer service. So they have very detailed instructions on how to create a Bitcoin wallet, fund it with, cash, U.S. dollars, and then make the payment. So Bitcoin is a type of what they call a cryptocurrency. Without getting into the technical details of how it works, it's basically a way to anonymously transact with other parties. But it's also secure from the standpoint that the transactions that are recorded to the Bitcoin system, if you want to call it that, are distributed amongst thousands and thousands of nodes within the Bitcoin network. And all of these nodes are called ledgers, and once all of the ledgers or enough ledgers agree that a transaction is valid, the transaction will then be recorded. So all you have is your Bitcoin wallet number, and that's really the only identifier in the system. It doesn't need your name, it doesn't need your social security number, or any other type of identifying information. And then once the payment is made to the attacker can you know, tumble the money. They can launder it within different Bitcoin laundering mechanisms and then convert it to a national currency so that they can use the money.
Interesting. Okay, what other, Chris, should we think about in terms of what should companies now be doing from the technical side to address the issue? If they haven't been affected yet, what should they be doing?
Well, for this particular type of attack, I would say the number one thing to do is to make sure your machines are patched. If the computers that were affected were properly updated, then this would not have happened. But in addition to that, it's really important for organizations to have antivirus on their computers and anti-malware systems running on their email server or in front of their email server. Those are sort of the main technical defenses in order to stop the stuff from getting to the user. Ultimately, all of these technical defenses rely on the fact that they're able to detect these things when they are sent to you, and they are not foolproof, which means it's also very important for organizations to train their users. Eventually, every organization is going to have a malicious email that is sent to an individual, and a trained workforce that is able to spot these types of emails will be in a much better position from a defense standpoint than one that is not. In case anybody actually gets ransomware, one option to recover is to restore from backups. So the better a backup solution an organization has, if all of those other defense mechanisms fail, at least there's a fallback then to recover data that has been encrypted or blocked or what have you from the attack. And then what we're also starting to see is a lot of tools are being published by the security industry for free, actually. A lot of the antivirus companies are publishing tools to decrypt or recover from these ransomware attacks if they occur. And there's actually a website called nomoreransom.org, which consolidates the tools offered by all these different security companies. So that's also an option. Presuming that you've gotten a variety of ransomware for which there is a recovery tool.
Well, those are excellent points, and I would echo especially the employee education. I know both of us have been speaking on that issue a lot of late, and I think that is just really the weak spot in a lot of cybersecurity. Clearly, you can have the best software, the best IT staff, the best security staff, but employees continue, you know, to be the weak link in any cybersecurity program. Estimates I've seen are 25 to 35% of cyber incidents and breaches are caused by just plain old-fashioned employee error. And so that is really where companies are trying to mitigate the risk and where they can focus right off the get-go to immediately address it. I actually wrote an article last year that said 2016 would be the year of ransomware, and a statistic I just saw says that in 2016, 483,800 incidents were due to ransomware. And so that, you know, that's just becoming, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but in the dark web, this is an easy way, you know, if you want to kind of get in this cyber criminal game, it's pretty easy to buy, you know, a code for ransomware at a nominal cost or to hire somebody to do it on the dark web, and you're up and running in the world of cybercrime. It's kind of made everybody able to buy their way in if they wanted to get into this area.
Yeah, there's a very low barrier of entry to into getting into ransomware. A lot of the code is out there. It's the it seems to me to be the about as difficult to get into as doing a snatch and grab on the street. I mean, it's that easy if an attacker has even the most modest level technical prowess.
Right. And so, you know, I think for our audience, they need to understand that kind of the old-fashioned cyber attack of a frontal assault on the network, you know, has seems to have gone by the wayside to some degree, and now the social engineering, tricking the employees to let them in the network, has become the new angle. And so, you know, I had an incident recently, and it's happening an amazing amount, where a client, a CFO, almost got tricked into wiring a $1 million wire because the email truly looked like it came from the CEO and had some urgency to it about a deal needed to close, and literally was one keystroke away from executing the wire, and for whatever reason decided to pick up the phone and verify the request. But I've had, in the last 4 years, at least four clients have been taken by falling for that man in the middle, is what they call it, email scheme, where they've been tricked into wiring out money because of a spoofed email using, where the opposing side was using Gmail, Hotmail, which is very hackable from what I've been told by the law enforcement. And so, you know, again, employee error is just so rampant. And it's not just training once. You know, tell me if you agree, Chris, but, you know, this is something statistics I've read and have been told is, you know, you do pretty intensive training and within 6 weeks, you know, human nature's kicking in again and you have some backsliding and people are slipping back to their old habits. And so it's not just an annual training or a casual mention of a practice pointer here and there. It needs to be kind of thorough and fairly regular in order to train the employees. Then you need to test the employees and internally test them through fake social engineering to see if they fall for it, then retrain those people and just keep at it.
Yeah, I agree. It's a continuous process, and the reason it's a continuous process is because, you know, for years there's sort of been this mindset that, you know, oh, IT security, that's the IT team's job. You know, that's not my job. If I get an email, I'm going to click on it because it better be clean. If it made it to my inbox, it must be safe. Or if the company's letting me go to this website, it must be safe. And so a training, I always felt, needs to do a couple of things. It needs to, of course, educate the employees as to what risks are out there and what risks they're going to face, but it also needs to motivate them to be cognizant and to sort of abandon that mindset that, oh, this is the IT team's job. Now, actually, IT security is a shared responsibility. Yes, the vast majority of the work goes to the IT team, but employees need to know that there is no 100% technical solution that can protect them. And because of that, they need to know that, you know, they've got some skin in the game also, because if there's an attack, it could affect the employees. It could result in their own identity theft. It's not just going to be, you know, some, you know, the nebulous idea of somebody in the front office, right? It's going to be the stockholders. So it's not me. No, it actually could very well be you. Employees are regularly compromised in cyber events.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, I do think, you know, this is kind of really not only circling the wagons, but getting everybody to understand, you know, from the president of a company down to the receptionist or somebody on the loading dock, that everybody is a stakeholder in cybersecurity and everybody has a role and responsibility, because if you don't do that, now you've created that weak link, and the higher officials in a company need to live by the same mantra and training they're giving to the employees. It really not only has to be preached, but everybody has to take some ownership, because that's really where you see problems is if the employees don't see the president, the director, and those people following it as well, then they do not believe that it really applies or that the company believes it's that important. And so I appreciate you stressing that, because that's really just an area that I'm finding where clients have been, frankly, behind the eight ball. And I understand it. It takes time. People aren't productive when they're sitting in a conference room being trained and then having to take a test or do something to follow up. But it's just, you know, for certain companies, this is a bet the company proposition for them. Can they survive? I think, Chris, I've heard you in presentations with me give a statistic that, you know, smaller businesses on average within 6 months go out of business because they can just not withstand the costs of a cyber breach.
That's right. I think it was the statistic I heard was 60% of small businesses go out of business within 6 months of a breach, which really does stress the impact. When you were mentioning the tone at the top, that sort of brought back to mind, tone at the top is just one of the benefits of a good governance program inside an organization. And when I was listing, I guess, all of those things that companies need to be doing to protect themselves from ransomware, I said, keep your systems up to date, have antivirus, have a malware appliance in front of your email. Well, those are the technical solutions, but there needs to be these a governance structure in place that says, this person in the company is responsible for doing these things. Because without that structure, there tends to be these types of things falling through the crack. And if you have a good governance structure that assigns responsibility, lays out an information security policy for an organization, then those activities identified in the policy are a lot more likely to be followed than not. So I think that's a critical piece. And I think far too often we have this conception that cybersecurity is just a technical field, and it's not. There's a huge element of governance. Management plays a very large role. So you've got the governance piece, you have a technical piece, and obviously, Colin, there's a huge legal piece. So maybe if you want to tell us a little bit about some of the legal implications that ransomware may have for an organization or other cyber legal considerations that folks need to be thinking about.
Yeah, no, perfect segue, Chris, and that's right where we're at, I think, in the discussion. So the legal implications of a ransomware event or a breach, and for our audience, we never, I always preach to my clients, we never like to call it a breach until you absolutely have to, because once you start using that term, which is really a loaded term in the legal area, it implicates the 48 separate notification laws that the various states. So legal implications for cyber are much more addressed at the state level than the federal level, and one size does not fit all. So a company that's sitting in Richmond and does internet sales and has clients around the country actually can find itself subjected to every one of those states' different notification laws based on whether it's a breach or how that state defines the obligations. And most of the statutes look to where the, quote, victim is located, not where the breached company is located. And there's a false sense of security for businesses that they are only being regulated by the state where they are headquartered or incorporated, and that is absolutely not how the legislation has been taken around the country. They view it from protecting their citizens in that state. And so be rest assured that California thinks, you know, you will be subjected to their statute, not the Virginia version. And, of course, California is going to have a much higher requirement of what you're going to do than some other states. So what I like to really tell companies is they need to really understand what their cyber risk is. Because this mentality, especially of small and medium-sized businesses, of I'm too small to be on the radar, nobody's looking at my company, I'm not taking tons of credit cards, and I'm not open to the general public like a retail establishment, so I'm not on the criminal radar, is completely wrong, and has been unfortunately created because the big incidents that get media attention are the Targets and the Home Depots and the Neiman Marcuses of the world, because they have a large number of customers that are affected. But Target, fortunately, had $100 million in cyber insurance and has spent $180 million addressing their cyber breach. I don't know how many on the call understand how Target got breached, but I think it's important to show the ramifications and the liability. Target was breached because their HVAC vendor, their heating and air conditioning vendor, was tied in to their computer network so that the vendor could control and monitor the heating and air conditioning in certain stores. And that vendor is where the hackers got into. That vendor became the weak link, and the hackers got into Target through that vendor. Target's still around. We all know that. That HVAC vendor was out of business in 6 weeks because clearly that vendor had no ability to withstand liability that Target brought upon it and could never have insured through cyber insurance. So companies on the call that are in that vendor role, service provider role, have a lot of exposure. They have their own exposure. And if you're tied into systems for billing and ordering purposes and invoicing purposes, you have your own exposure because now you're the third party that could create the liability for your prime contractor, and they can push that back on you. They may do it through a contract. They may ask you to promise you're carrying certain security levels or carrying certain cyber insurance. And if you don't, you've bought yourself liability. And just like any old negligence case, they may say you are negligent and bring the case against you under a common law claim for negligence. And so companies that find themselves in that role of providing services for others really have kind of a double whammy of liability. They have their own exposure, and then they have exposure to the companies they do business with and provide services for. The same for medical practices. They have exposure for all their patients and customers. The interesting thing is, and this is where WannaCry, I think for the first time, really heightens this issue. So you have two kinds of exposure in a cyber incident. You have what we call your first party exposure. That's the company's losses. Just as if your warehouse burned down or your office building flooded, that's your loss and you make that claim on your commercial property insurer. That's your first party claim. If you're a tenant, you might have a claim against the landlord for not doing anything, but it's really your loss to your assets. You have the third-party claim, which is to the customers or to the public you're dealing with. Those claims to date have not had any stickiness to them because the customers have not had any real damages. So you hear the Targets of the world and these retailers, which are a very good example, but all of the Target customers have had very tough class action status, and that's how these cases are brought, because they have no damages. Yes, their credit card may have been compromised, but the credit card company usually catches it pretty quickly, and if it's a fraudulent charge, the cardholder is not responsible. So the customers have no real damages. To date, the real costs in a cyber event have been those first-party costs, hiring Chris to come in and find out where the problem is and stop it and resecure the network. Hiring me to come in and coach you through this 47 notification laws if you have to do something, and to make sure we have the attorney-client privilege on top of everything. But those are the public relations group that comes in and helps you interface with your customers. Those first-party costs have been the most expensive aspect of a breach. So Wanamaker. Wanamaker had a disproportionate effect so far on hospitals and healthcare entities, and I'm not sure why. I don't know the technical side as to why they were targeted. I'm told it's because their networks are so open that it was able to spread. Now we get a different problem because we don't have just monetary damages. Let's assume that I was going to a hospital, and this has happened. I mean, there was a hospital system up in the Washington, D.C. area, MedStar, that was ransomwared, could not access their backup, and they had 30 days of disruption of having to, they couldn't get into the patient files. They couldn't, you know, the schedules for the surgeries were unavailable. There was a hospital in Los Angeles that got ransomwared, but they paid the ransom, $30,000, and got it unlocked. But MedStar did not pay in time and lost their data for the most part, and did not have, as Chris mentioned, a robust backup system that they could bring everything back up online really quickly. So let's say that happens, and now the patient's surgery is postponed because nobody knows, you know, I was showing up today for my surgery, and I don't get my surgery, and I end up dying. Who's liable for that? Now we have an issue because now we don't have monetary, we have bodily injury. We have personal injury. And so now the standing, see, in the monetary, there's no damages because nobody's really incurred a financial loss. The credit card wipes off the fraudulent charge. The IRS fixes the fraudulent tax refund, and you get your refund. Now we have a real damage. We have somebody dying or physically being injured. Or we might have where, you know, a security system doesn't work, and so somebody has a theft in their warehouse. That now gives these customers, the public, the third party standing to bring the claim. That's a new Wanamaker really changes that. And so now we have a really potential for liability. And that's where an insurance angle comes into it. So if you have cyber insurance, which is critical, small businesses think they can't afford it. You can afford it. You can get a decent $1 million or $2 million cyber insurance policy for a very reasonable premium for a small business that's a local, you know, solely owned, privately held business. Same for medium. It's getting a more expensive, but it's out there. But there's a kicker. Cyber insurance does not cover bodily injury or property damage for third parties. The question is, will your general liability insurance pick that up? Because general liability tries to exclude cyber losses. So there is an angle of due diligence here that you want to make sure all of your insurance then is working together, because as Chris said, 60-some percent of small and medium-sized businesses fail. You can survive it if you have cyber insurance and the right insurance, but you've got to make sure there are no gaps in your insurance program. And that's critical. And so what we're really seeing here, Chris, to bring it full circle, is Wanamaker has opened a door here that may create new avenues of liability that really before now were not seen. And plaintiffs, those that sue, could not really get their claims to stick. Now, there were other exposures, right? So Target, P.F. Chang's had a huge exposure, and they've had their own liability issues, not from their customers, but from their credit card processing bank because of the cost of issuing new credit cards, and then Visa and MasterCard and American Express push that cost back down the chain to the merchant that was breached. So there are other avenues. As I mentioned, if you're a service provider or a vendor, you may have a problem that you created the breach and had somebody's data on your system or allowed the breach to occur through your system. But what WannaMaker has shown now is, could there be that liability for the personal injury or bodily injury? And if that is the case, that's the holy grail for the plaintiff's lawyers, because that then can create a potential class action. And as I'm sure most of our audience on the call knows, that's where the gargantuan litigation costs can come from, that can really become a bet the company proposition in a lot of instances. And that's frankly what the plaintiff's lawyers and the plaintiff's bar have been looking to do now for the last several years, is be able to pierce that standing. So that's, to answer your question on liability, that is where we're headed if we continue to see ransomware like this that can now create injuries for customers and the general public.
Right. So you were talking about cyber insurance. Now, you know, I've owned a couple of homes in my time, and the homeowner's insurance policy seemed to look pretty similar to me. Is the same sort of true in cyber insurance? Are the policies fairly standard, or is there a lot of variability?
Actually, in the cyber world, Chris, it is the cyber insurance world. We call it the wild, wild west. And not to sound, you know, kind of silly about it, but this is still, and cyber insurance is still a fairly new product to the market, and it is being refined constantly as new aspects of cyber risk are learned. The insurers are adapting to that to try to be able to underwrite that risk and offer it as a line of coverage. Unlike what you mentioned, a homeowner's policy, an auto policy, even what I'm sure most of our audience is caring for their business, the commercial general liability, those forms have been around for literally decades. They are very standard across all insurers. There are a couple of organizations that write those policies, and then insurers just license the ability to use them and then tweak them for their particular insurance company, but they're very uniform. I mean, the general commercial general liability policy, everybody gets the same 17 or so pages, and then endorsements tweak it a little bit. That is absolutely not true for cyber insurance. Every insurer uses their own forms, and they do not use and define terms the same. They do not offer the same coverage. It is very complex. Cyber insurance can have upwards of 10 to 11 separate insuring agreements. I have seen carriers, insurance carriers, issue definitions up into the 50, 60 separate definitions, which can actually then restrict coverage based on how something is defined. It is critical that companies have cyber insurance. It is critical that you do a level of due diligence so that when you need it, and it's really not if, it is probably when, that it will be there. And since no two policies are created alike, you really have to work with a sophisticated, educated, knowledgeable insurance broker or agent. And not to sound self-serving, but this is one area where an insurance coverage lawyer can really help give that second opinion and work with the insurance broker to tighten the insurance policy up, because the brokers work at one level and the insurance coverage lawyer is working at a very different level. And what I like to say is, it's unfortunately, and this is true and it's more and more true, it's not what the insurance broker says the insurance policy means. It's not what the owner or risk manager of a company says it means when they read it. It's frankly not what the insurer says it means. Ultimately, it's a judge. If there's going to be a dispute and it's going to go to court, a judge is going to have to look at that and decide if there's coverage or not. And the P.F. Chang's case is a quintessential example. The insurance company promoted literature that said it's the greatest insurance, cyber insurance out there. It covers everything. P.F. Chang's believed that. I'm sure their insurance broker believed that. And a federal judge said it doesn't cover the cost to reissue credit cards. And so P.F. Chang's ate that cost. And so it's important, but this is not your usual insurance that companies are used to buying and have been buying for years and years and decades to cover their losses. There is a different level of requirements with cyber insurance. And it really, to your point, Chris, there is nothing similar about it. There are a lot of even nuances between the U.S. market and the U.S.-based insurers and the London market, Lloyd's of London and the syndicates that issue insurance. They take a different approach to it. And even the carriers take a different approach to handling and addressing a cyber breach. You can buy coverage for ransomware. That is a separate line of coverage. Cyber extortion can be covered. You have to buy that line of coverage. It doesn't come in the policy. It's a separate insuring agreement that you have to buy, and so it can be bought. The insurer will pay the Bitcoin ransom. They know how to get Bitcoin, and they can pay the ransom, and they will do it. And then if other things are triggered from a ransomware event, all the other services and coverage can kick in. But again, you got to know what you're buying. You've got to understand what the policy requires. The devil is definitely buried in the details. For example, and this, again, Wanamaker is really opening a lot of eyes on this. Most cyber insurance says you must be patching regularly your system. Microsoft, in this incident, issued the patch that would have prevented Wanamaker, I think you referenced it, Chris, in March of this year. So obviously, you know, 3 months ago, the patch was issued by Microsoft for the more recent software. I think some of the software, the older versions of Windows that were end of life, were not, the patch wasn't issued because Microsoft had stopped issuing patches, although they've done that now, I'm told, even for the older versions. But, so then the question becomes, what if you didn't patch? What if you only patch on a certain schedule? So there are a lot of tricky nuances to cyber insurance, and so it is well worth the time and the due diligence to make sure, because it's not cheap and you want to make sure it's going to work and stand behind the company, because in the end, cyber insurance is the ultimate backstop to a loss. If you haven't been able to shift the risk contractually to another party, you can't stand and can't hold that appetite of self-insuring that level of risk. Insurance is always the backstop, right? Everybody buys or implements fire suppression in their commercial office or warehouse or distribution center, but you also buy insurance in case it burns down to shift the risk on the insurer. So it is well worth looking at. It is viable for many, many businesses. And you do need to know what you're buying, because it is. I hear a lot on one of the business radio shows, you know, cyberpolicy.com. They can, I think, write your insurance in under, or get you quotes in under 4 minutes. I am shocked. I can't imagine what you're getting, because underwriting in these policies is not easy and it takes effort itself. So there's a lot of homework to do, but it can really be worthwhile.
Great. So we got a few questions coming in.
Yeah. Give them right before we start, Chris. Let's give them your email address just one more time for people that may have jumped in after the introduction in case somebody else wants to send it in. Can you just give them your email address one more time?
Absolutely. And so everybody who's on the KITER email distribution who received the invite from KITER, you can just respond to the invitation. For everybody else, you'll have to listen to me drone on with my last name and all the consonants in it. So the email address is CMOSCHELLA@KITERCPA.com, and KITER is KEITER. So that's CMOSCHELLA@KITERCPA.com.
Great. Okay, let's go, Chris. What's our first question?
All right, so we've got a couple here, one on the technical side and one on the legal side. The first one says, what do ransomware emails look like? We have a particular type of security appliance on our server. Will this give us extra security from this? I'm looking at the name of the security appliance. I don't know how to pronounce it. I've never heard it pronounced before, but it's Merakai, M-E-R-A-K-I. And to the individual who asked the question, I would say I cannot particularly attest to that specific appliance, but when it comes to ransomware, there's a particular capability that the really good malware appliances have. And what they do is they have, sometimes it's called advanced threat protection, sometimes it's called sandboxing. And what it does is whenever an attachment comes in through email, the sandbox will open the file well away from where your computers are. It opens it up, in the sandbox so it can't get out, and then it observes the file. So if it's opening up a Microsoft Word document and the document is behaving the way a Word document does, it says, okay, it passes this check, we'll send it through all the other checks and send it on to the recipient. If, however, the sandbox opens the file and it says, wait a second, this Word document is trying to access my computer's registry, it's trying to map network drives, it's trying to download crypto keys from the internet, the sandbox is going to say, whoa, hold on. This Word document is not acting the way a Word document is supposed to act. We're just going to leave it right there and not send it to the user. So that type of functionality, the last I heard, that's sort of the best in class type of feature that you want to look for when you are looking at appliances to stop ransomware at the server. So I hope that answers that question. On the legal side, Colin, I imagine a lot of people have this question. There's a lot of businesses process credit cards, but usually when businesses process credit cards, they outsource the credit processing to a third party. So the question reads, if we process our customers' credit card purchases online through an outside vendor, if they were breached, would we be a third-party victim?
Okay, so that's an interesting question, and let's start with my phrase, everybody loves the cloud, but the cloud doesn't love you. So a lot of companies are using cloud providers, and that's a little different than the credit card purchase, but it goes to the same thing. It's always your data. And many companies think if they use a credit card vendor, if they keep their data on a cloud provider, it's now I've moved the data onto somebody else's platform, so it's their issue and they'll protect me and address it if there's a problem. Almost uniformly, that's not true. Cloud providers hate to give indemnity obligations back to their customers and hold harmless agreements, and it's always your data. So if it happens at a cloud provider, they may be liable to you in some respect, or you may be able to make a claim, but the attorneys generals around the country are going to look at it as that's your data and you need to respond to it and to the breach, whether the cloud provider does or doesn't. It's your data and you have to take care of it. So now to the credit card and cloud providers And so obviously this applies to, you know, almost every business. Doctors put their records on the cloud or on offsite servers, et cetera. So the first thing is obviously on that kind of information, make sure, you know, there are backups and that the ransomware, if it infects your network, and Chris, this is more to the technical, but it can't then replicate into the backup. I've heard of instances where companies did not separate their backup properly from the live network, and so the ransomware, as it's spreading throughout the network, goes ahead and spreads into the backup system as well and locks it down so the company can't use the backup to come back up online and get live again. The way you would tackle the credit card purchases, the cloud providers, et cetera, first is to look at the contract, the agreement. Who is trying to shift the risk where in that agreement? Is the processor saying, we have no liability, you keep it all to their customers? Are they taking some of that liability on, but are you still keeping some of it yourself? Same with the cloud provider. It's going to start with the contract. And that's a negotiation. And, of course, the larger entities have probably, in some respects, the bargaining power. I mean, Microsoft, their cloud service is, you know, going to be the 800-pound gorilla, and their contract probably is not very negotiable. Same with Amazon. Of course, you expect them to have a certain level of security, and they are marketing that they are at a certain level of security. And of course, they want to keep their reputation, so they're going to be doing good things anyway. But it's going to start with the contract. And you have to see what the contract says so that you know what your risk is. Are they taking it? Do we have that obligation, i.e., becomes your risk? And you've got to look at that. Then you would ultimately backstop it with cyber insurance. Cyber insurance will cover your data on another party's system. So many companies obviously outsource their payroll because nobody wants to have to monitor the hours and the wage claims and the W-2s and such, and so, you know, and the direct deposits. So they outsource that. But that's still your data. That company now has your employees' social security numbers and information. Cyber insurance can backstop that breach and respond to it at an outside vendor if you purchase the coverage. So you've got to make sure you're purchasing the right coverage because, again, you can ultimately backstop that loss through your own insurance. Now, in the contract, you want to make sure the vendor you're kind of setting up. We want you to have certain level of security. We want you to carry a certain level of cyber insurance. You can ask them to do those things. But ultimately, you know, what if that vendor can't withstand the wherewithal and goes under? You know, the contract is only as good as the company can stand behind it or does what they promise to do. You still may own that risk in the end. And so that's where cyber insurance can kick in. It's a great question. Because we are becoming so interconnected now and people are outsourcing a lot of back office functions that, you know, it doesn't make sense for them to do or try to do internally. But you got to really start with the contract. Same as with regular, you know, other insurance. You're asking somebody to make you an additional insured. You're asking them to carry certain insurance. You do the same with cybersecurity and cyber insurance. And so it really becomes a matter of the contract and then a matter of what the insurance provisions are. Okay. I hope that answers that question. It's an interesting question, and it does create – that's a lot of exposure, obviously, through those processes.
Right. So here's another one.
Go ahead.
So this question says that the WannaCry attack targeted unsupported software. What can companies do to protect themselves if they're forced to run older software? So this is a really good question because a lot of companies need to operate equipment. One of the reasons the medical industry is targeted is because a lot of medical devices are forced to run specific versions of software, and because they're not tested on other versions of software, they're actually not allowed to run updates, and they may not even be allowed to run security patches on particular medical devices, because it could be somebody's life on the line if software starts misbehaving after a security update. So the question is, how do you protect systems that are that have to be insecure in order to function? And I guess the answer is that, you know, I can't say you need to do X, Y, and Z, because it's going to depend on the particular system and that system's needs. But I would say, in general, I mean, a good analogy is children riding in a car. You know, when I get into a car, I put on a seatbelt, and that's enough. But when my kids get into the car, we've got to strap them into car seats and, you know, do all the rest. And they've got these, you know, they're encased in foam and all sorts of other stuff that, you know, Graco says that I need to buy for my kids. And, but the reason is because they are more vulnerable in a car than I am. And so we need to provide them extra protection. So if you're forced to run these systems, the answer is you need to provide extra protection for those systems. And it can come in a variety of fashions, right? You could have firewalls, which control the traffic coming to and from systems. If you were to add an additional firewall in front of those insecure systems in order to restrict the traffic to that which is only absolutely necessary for them to operate, then you'll likely cut down on a lot of the threat landscape. If the particular software, maybe it's Windows XP, Microsoft is not issuing patches anymore, maybe there's still good antivirus programs that still run on XP. Look for those. So you need to look for additional ways to protect these systems that are sort of going to be insecure by default.
And I would think in that instance, you now that they know that's a risk, they would want a really robust, you know, written information security program that's addressing that and really educating the employees, because now you know you've got a level of risk that you might not otherwise have.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gets back to governance. You know, a key part of the governance process is doing a risk assessment. And doing a risk assessment is documenting the software and hardware that's on your network. So during a risk assessment, you would be able to identify, oh, we have a machine running Windows XP. Windows XP is no longer supported. Therefore, we need to implement some additional security mechanisms in order to safeguard those assets.
That's a good point. And I'm a huge proponent, as I know you are, of companies doing a cyber risk assessment. I mean, if you don't know what your problems are and where your gaps are, you know, it's a little tough to address them. And my view is, if you haven't done a cyber risk assessment and know that and then start addressing it, all of your cybersecurity measures, you're just kind of taking a stab in the dark and hoping you get it right and you're at the right level, because nothing's really guiding you in a strategic way. You're just kind of plugging holes and kind of become the boy in the dike trying to put your fingers in, and at some point you just can't keep doing it because there are too many and you don't know what's there.
That's exactly right, and I think that sort of hits the nail on the head on one of the biggest challenges with cybersecurity is where to invest dollars. There's a finite number of dollars that business can invest in cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is not a money-making venture for the companies that need to purchase protections. So the money that they do spend, they need to spend wisely, and a good risk assessment or an IT audit or a security audit can help inform those decisions.
Well, and that's a great point, and we'll probably wrap up. We're right at the hour that, you know, while it's not a money-making, sometimes you have to spend some money to save a lot of money. And one of the statistics I cite a lot is companies that don't have an information security program, policies in place, and don't have an incident response plan, you know, the cost of responding to a cyber event when you're not prepared, you haven't tested it, you don't test it to know it works, are 2 to 3 times more than if you are prepared. And certainly the cost up front of doing a cyber risk assessment and getting your house in order is hugely less expensive than responding to a full-on breach and all of that. And so Well, yes, it's not a revenue generator. It may protect the revenue stream because if you don't have it in order, that may be disrupted to a point, going back to your statistic, that 60% of the businesses can't then withstand the problem and go under because they have that revenue stream is disrupted too much. Well, that's our program. We appreciate everyone joining us today. We hope you found it very beneficial. In the invitation, you have our contact information. We are more than happy. If we were all in a conference room together, we'd stand around and say we're happy to continue talking and answering your questions, and we are happy to continue receiving your emails or reaching out to us if you have additional questions or concerns about this topic in cybersecurity. We would love to help you and be a resource, so please reach out to us with your questions. As I mentioned at the beginning, we've recorded this presentation. By, at the latest, I would think early next week, it will be posted on our website so that if you have others in your offices you would like to have listen, please direct them to it and they can listen to the presentation if you find that would be beneficial for them. And we, again, thank everybody for joining us today, and we look forward to hosting you on a future presentation. Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon.